Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate all the love and the support that I've been getting thus far. Thank you so much. I want to continue to ask you all for your support in helping me to make this podcast a success. You can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, Venmo. Also, you can go over to the podcast page on Patreon, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon, and you can support. Anything that you do would be greatly appreciated. A dollar episode or a $50 donation once a year or whatever you can do to help would only help to support the podcast. And I truly appreciate anything and everything that you can do in order to help me keep this podcast going and growing. Also, because I joined this new application site or this new hosting site called Podbean, you can also go straight to the Podbean site. There you can also become a subscriber, as well as there's a Patreon page on the Podbean site there as well. So you can support the podcast through that avenue as well. So head on over to Podbean, Patreon, Cash App, PayPal, and Venmo in order to support the podcast. I want to encourage you all to rate, subscribe, and share no matter what platform you're listening to it on, this podcast on. Podbean, Spotify, Spreaker, Breaker, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Play, Apple Music, no matter where you're listening to this podcast at, please make sure that you give it that 5-star rating, that you subscribe to it, and please remember to share it. Tell someone about an episode through email, through word of mouth, however you get that information out there. I truly, truly appreciate it. So I'm always looking for guests and for topics. So if you have a guest in mind that you'd like for me to have on the podcast, and or if there's a topic that you'd like me to discuss, send me an email, cptlhunter@gmail.com, or reach out to me however you do. And I will certainly do the best that I can to get that guest on here. And I'll also give you a shout out. So if you want to get a shout out on the show, just reach out to me and give me an idea for a topic and or a guest. And last but not least, in the lines of announcements, is the fact that I've dropped two online courses. First course is going to be for police officers who want to take a promotional exam, police officer preparational course. So what you can do is you can head over to hunterpolicetraining.com, look at the online courses, and from there you can click on that part and you can see the two courses that I have. And one of them is obviously, as I just mentioned, the police officer promotional exam course, in which those people who are going for the rank of sergeant, lieutenant, captain, etc., can sign up for the course. I know how we officers think it many times. We don't like for people to know what we're doing. We try to keep things on the low. So here's a chance and an opportunity for you to get my services in order to help you pass those promotional exams. Maybe you're too busy to give me a call, but now you can access the information that I have via the online course. And of course, I'm always still available if you want to reach out and just have a conversation with me and just meet me one-on-one for those services. And the second course, online course I have, is for those people who want to become police officers. So if you want to become a police officer, or you know someone who wants to become a police officer, you have a cousin, a nephew, a niece, an aunt, or someone in your family or close-knit circle, or maybe there's a group that you're a part of and you want them to consider a career in law enforcement, then I now have dropped an online course for those people who are considering that career path. It is a preparational exam course preparing people for the exam, as well as it'll give you some insights on how to get ready for the police academy. So those are two online courses that I have, and I'm going to be dropping a couple more within the next few weeks. So keep an eye out for that. And so I really appreciate all the love and support that I've gotten about that. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into the episode today. I have been looking forward to having this man on the podcast for some time. He wrote a book that I read. It's called The End of Policing, a great, great book, which he's not really, really advocating for the end of police, but he's talking about the way that we're doing it, how we go about policing. And I think that his ideas are really not revolutionary. It really just looks at the data and understands the things that we have tried and whether those things are actually working or not. And the man's name is Alex S. Vitale. Let me just read a little bit of Professor Vitale's bio. Professor of Sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and a visiting professor at London South Bank University. He has spent the last 25 years writing about policing and consults both police departments and human rights organizations internationally. He also serves on the New York State Advisory Committee of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Professor Vitali is the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, and The End of Policing. His academic writings on policing have appeared in Policing and Society, Police Practice and Research, Mobilization, and Contemporary Sociology. He is also a frequent essayist whose writings have appeared in the New York Times, New York Daily News, The Nation, Vice News, Jacobin, and USA Today. Great interview that you guys are going to be in store for. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is Alex Vitali, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College. Here's an interview with him. Thank you for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. I am on with Professor Alex Vitali. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
So let me just start off with the beginning here is, just tell us a little bit about yourself. I did read over your bio to the audience, but if you could just tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm a professional academic these days, teaching at Brooklyn College, as you mentioned. But I've been working on these criminal justice related issues for about 30 years now in a variety of capacities as a writer, an organizer, a researcher, consultant in various ways. So these are issues that have been kind of central to me for decades, both, you know, intellectually and politically. And I got my start working at the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness in the late 80s and early 90s, dealing with the beginnings of what, you know, we figured out what turned out to be broken windows policing. And I think one of the themes that's run throughout my work over this 30 years is fighting back against this idea that the problems of homelessness and poverty and overdoses, et cetera, are to be dealt with by the criminal justice system. And that every time we turn a problem over to them, we're really denying our responsibility for creating that problem and, in a sense, blaming the victim.
Wow. Now, that was the 80s and 90s. That had to be very revolutionary at the time, right?
At the time, you know, people were not really looking closely at the criminal justice system. Mass incarceration was underway, but gets much worse during that period. And the discourse around, you know, the new Jim Crow and police abolition really didn't exist much. It was a very, very tangential kind of minor discourse. And so a lot of us doing this work were having to kind of find our way, if you will, on our own. And obviously, the political landscape has changed dramatically over the last 5 years or so.
Did you and other academics know that it was the new Jim Crow? I mean, I only became familiar with that term because of Michelle Alexander. Did you know that something was going on when they were specifically targeting certain neighborhoods and communities?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a critical academic scholarship that has been around for a long time. And of course, we can look to community struggles as well. But, you know, you think about Angela Davis's work and others who, you know, pointed out that the criminal justice system and the basic outlines of American democracy are suffused with a history of racism and profound economic inequalities. There just weren't a lot of people who were kind of connecting the dots clearly, and whether it was on the ground where we were so tied up with single issue politics in the 1980s and 90s. So some people were concerned about, you know, reproductive rights, and some people were concerned about solidarity with struggles in Central America, and some people were working on anti-apartheid struggles. And our movements were really fractured, and that single issue focus, I think, kept us from developing a deeper analysis. So what's exciting about the current moment is the growing number of people who understand that policing can't be fixed through some superficial procedural, you know, adjustments to training, that we have to get to this deeper analysis about the role that policing plays and has always played in reproducing profound inequalities. And so we have to structure our movements around that deeper analysis so that we don't just try to fix a really bad system.
And that's what's so profound to me is trying to, as you mentioned, trying to fix a system. Now, what brought you to my attention is that I'm, you know, kind of scrolling through the internet, researching different things, and I come across this new notion. At least it's new to me, to my ears. Abolishing the police, abolishing prisons, and that really struck me as very, very radical. And so that's kind of where I came across you, came across your book, The End of Policing, read the book, thought it was very great. And so what caused you to write the book?
So I had the idea for the book, actually, and basically a deal with my publisher before Ferguson happened, before Eric Garner was killed here in New York. And at the time, I thought it would be kind of just a little bit of a contribution for a handful of activists and kind of radical scholars. What motivated me to write it was the years that I had spent involved in policing and struggles around policing that I thought were ultimately very unproductive. And the pattern I was used to seeing was that the police would commit some horrible offense, usually killing someone or, like in the case of Rodney King, you know, severely beating them. There would be community outrage and there would be a set of demands. We want, you know, more diverse police forces and better training, and we want a couple of cops to get indicted. And then one or two of those things would maybe happen. The movement would collapse and nothing would really change. And then another horrible thing would happen and the same demands would get trotted out, that really in no possible scenario would those demands make any real difference in policing. And I'll just give you one example if I can. Here in New York, when Amadou Diallo was killed,
right,
Reverend Sharpton took a leadership role in expressing the community outrage about that. And he pulled together some high profile people and community activists and started doing really impressive civil disobedience actions at police headquarters. And I took part in these actions, was arrested with Jesse Jackson and other people. And but the demand of that movement was that the officers involved be indicted.
Right.
So in this middle of this great movement that's really building momentum, is really damaging Giuliani politically, the officers are indicted. The movement demobilizes, and then the courts just find them not guilty later.
Right.
Nothing changes. Nothing is built that has any lasting strength to it. So my goal was to write something to point out the weakness of that approach and the need for a deeper, more radical analysis so that the demands we put forward will actually lead to the kinds of changes we want.
I can remember being an officer. That was in 1997, I believe, in Amadou Diallo. I was 2 years on at the time, and I remember getting a lot of phone calls about that. Hey, what do you think about, you know, this case in New York and this, that, and the other? And then I'm not sure, long after that was the plunger incident where the officer stuck the plunger.
Yeah, Justin Volpe.
Yeah.
And Diallo was killed in 99.
In 99. Okay.
Yeah.
So these two incidents, you know, around the corner from me, I'm in Connecticut, so around the corner from me, really, you know, kind of shocked me to my core, but I didn't have the knowledge at the time to really kind of address it adequately. Of course, when people would call me, I would say, you know, this is what the law is, and this is why the officers took the action, particularly with the Amadou Diallo case. This is where they fired because they thought, you know, it's perception at the time.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff.
Yep.
So it really gives I appreciate the work that you've done, and Michelle Alexander, Angela Davis, all the work that people have done,
in order to bring a lot of this to people's attention and to get the lasting changes. And it never occurred to me to look at a deeper thing. You've been very critical in your book. You've been very critical of some of the reforms that people have tried to take, right? With police activity leagues, critical incident teams. I was a member of both of those, right? I was a member of the crisis intervention team. I coach with PAL and things like that. And you mentioned in the book that there's no statistical data that shows that these programs actually work.
That's right. That's just the, you know, the if only they did, you know, even as like a harm reduction strategy, then, you know, maybe we could find that a place for that in our demands. But as a police scholar, you know, who's been reading the literature for over 20 years, I can tell you that the vast majority of things that the police agree to as reforms are agreed to because they know they don't work. They're symbolic. They're designed to serve a political purpose, which is to divert the criticism. So the police will always say yes to like implicit bias training. Don't worry, you know, the racism problem, we're going to deal with it. And it's totally unintentional. We didn't mean it, but don't worry. We're going to give the officers an hour of training and that'll fix the problem. Well, of course, it couldn't possibly fix the problem. And every study ever done shows that it doesn't work, but it carries all this symbolic weight. And so we got to quit asking for things that they're perfectly happy to give us because they know it doesn't work.
Mm. What has been the response of the book as far as criticisms? I mean, I know that there was an article I read that you kind of went at. What's her name? Heather McDonald.
Yeah.
So I actually want to reach out to her at some point and have her on the podcast. But what has been the response of the book by other critics, more conservative members of society?
Well, mostly crickets.
Okay.
Nothing. I think it's really interesting. There have been almost no attacks on the book, no attacks on me. It's confusing. I joked with my publishers, what can we do to like manufacture some right wing attack on me, for the free publicity? I think, you know, part of it is that I was a fairly well-known police scholar at the time I wrote this. I have spent time with police all over the world, have advised police departments. So I don't say things in the book that are naive, are simplistic, or that just attack police as individuals or anything like that. A lot of police agree with a lot of what's in the book. They don't want to be in charge of mental health services. They don't want to be in charge of homelessness. They don't want to be in charge of the schools, you know, and that these are political decisions that are being made.
Right.
The police didn't create the war on drugs. And they can't end it. These are political problems. So I'm not one of these people who's out there yelling at every cop in the street and saying jail all cops or all cops are murderers. I'm not interested in any of that discourse. What I'm interested in is political accountability for those elected officials who keep turning every social problem into something for the police to fix.
Right. Do you think that your message has any resonance amongst the political officials?
Well, some. So I do get invitations to talk to folks. And what's been really gratifying is the number of political candidates around the country who have reached out to me to work with them on developing their criminal justice program. So I have people running for Congress, for state senates. I worked on the Bernie Sanders criminal justice platform. So in that regard, this message is penetrating and it's affecting what candidates are demanding when they run for office. Now we need more of these people to get elected and we need to see bigger transformations, you know, in legislatures. But definitely my work and the work of tons of other people, both academics and activists and people in the civil rights community, we're all getting on the same message, you know, about how pointless superficial training programs are and how we need real reinvestment in community needs. So I'm just thrilled to be a part of that conversation.
From the police aspect, why do you think that there's so much resistance? You talked about, you know, the police will give them what they want because they know,
yeah,
that they, you know, they give them. And I was an implicit bias trainer. I read the book and even watched a number of your other interviews. And of course, in this interview, you were really kind of attacking me where I was, because like I mentioned, I was, and I don't take offense to it at all. I mean, I think it's needed and necessary, you know,
not
I
was, personal.
Right. I was an implicit bias trainer. Still am, actually. Did the DePaul thing. I coached and had my kids involved in that. And all that kind of stuff. So I was trying to be on the front lines of the police reform movement as much as mm-hmm. possible. However, I see your point that it's not enough. The training isn't enough. So why do you think that the departments are so willing to give us that and not really push for more reforms? Or are they pushing for more reforms?
Well, there's a couple things going on here. You know, at the root of this, it's a battle over the scope of activity. And so every bureaucracy wants to maintain its scope of activity and grow itself. And so police executives don't want to give up personnel and responsibilities. So they fight to justify their big budgets and everything else, and to ward off criticism. Now, some police leaders are at least open to some discussion about partnering with other agencies, you know, and changing their approach to something, but very few are willing to say, oh, you're right, we don't want to be in the drug business anymore. You're right, let's just get out of sex work, stop this enforcement altogether. And you can disband our vice unit and give that money to, you know, domestic violence shelters. So that's part of it. The other thing is that there is a kind of thin blue line ideology throughout policing. You know, it's more intensive in some settings than others, and the unions are much worse than this than a lot of police leaders are. But too many police in the United States really believe that they are the solution to every problem, that the best solution is an authoritarian punitive intervention, that the only thing holding society together is, you know, the constant threat of violence and punishment at the hands of police, especially when it comes to the behavior of poor people and people of color. There's a lot of racism in that, and a lot of pessimism about human nature, and a lot of embracing of a kind of big daddy's going to fix everything authoritarianism. So we have to be clear about calling that ideological viewpoint out as toxic and ultimately racist, in my view. And that ideology, you know, is behind the kinds of political endorsements that get made, the kinds of positions that the police through their unions and their leadership take on bail reform and decriminalization of drugs and things like that. So one of the things that I support is these efforts underway in a lot of places to hold politicians responsible for taking endorsements from police and corrections unions when those unions embrace really toxic thin blue line politics. And to say, you know, people who are taking money from the sergeants union here in New York cannot be our political friends. Because when we look at the public statements of that union, they are racist. And they stand in the way of any kind of progressive change we're trying to make. So anyone who's taking that money can't be our friend.
Speaking of that, there was some kind of, with the Eric Garner incident, there were many off-duty officers, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe you know about this, many off-duty officers who were protesting the punishment that came with the officer who was ultimately fired.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Many, well, the unions, you know, obviously, not surprisingly, you know, defended him to the nth degree. But then not only were there protests, but I mean, there was a work slowdown across the board. They just quit doing their jobs. They took illegal strike action, essentially. And so which was not in, you know, no enforcement action was taken against them for doing that. Crime kept going down. So, yeah, there was organized opposition to holding that officer accountable for his behavior from top to bottom.
Madness. It's madness. I was listening to a racist one time. He was given an interview. I can't remember the guy's name. He's a member of the alt-right. And he was talking about the moral implications of what you're talking about before, if that crime is isolated in black neighborhoods because black people are morally whatever, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so he was saying that, you know, if in New York City, if black people were deported or whatever, that you could eliminate the police force. And this goes along with what we're talking about as far as the bureaucracy, that the police are in the business of just continuing what they're doing. Right. And so they're trying to grow their organization. So I think that gives a lot of credence to what you're saying as far as, you know, this racist guy who thinks that, you know, people, you know, brown people, black people are inherently a certain way and cannot help but to be this way. And the best way is to just eliminate them rather than eliminate the social evils and ills that that haunt their communities.
I mean, what's so shocking to me is not that some avowed white supremacist is saying this. What's shocking to me is the number of so-called Democratic politicians who carry this out, who turn every social problem in communities of color into a problem for the police to solve, so that they tell communities, no, we don't have any money to open up a comprehensive youth center. We don't have any money to hire more counselors in the schools. We don't have any money for high quality medical drug treatment, but we're going to fill your neighborhood with police. We're going to fill the schools with police because that's the only real way to solve this problem. And that is straight up racist. It says that these communities can only get better through punishment, threats, and violence. And that is the official policy of thousands of politicians across the country who claim to be our friends. And we have to say no to that. The solution to our community problems is not more police, because the tools that they have to solve problems are guns and handcuffs and arrests. And that's not what we need.
It clearly is not. It clearly has only done more of a, been more of a problem. You talked about the mental health issues. As far as in the book, you talked about the PMI, I believe that's persons with mental illness. So let's just kind of go through a couple of things here. And if you could just give us, you know, the brief synopsis of that. You talked about the mental health problems. Like I mentioned, I was a crisis intervention officer. How is this exacerbated by, you know, we closed down so many mental institutions, a place for these people to go. We've cut the services of people. I don't know if you saw the Joker movie.
Right. Yes. Really gets to the core of this issue, doesn't it?
Yeah. I actually did an episode about that movie because I saw the parallels between what was going on in society in that movie. But if you could just talk about the whole mental illness.
Sure. So, you know, over the last 40 years, we've embraced a politics of austerity that says that spending money on social services is just throwing money into a black hole, because the people we're trying to help don't want to be helped, can't really be helped, because they're ultimately morally incapable of being upstanding citizens.
Right.
So we have divested from the services such as, you know, we shut down the mental hospitals because of the development of new drugs and technologies and the fact that there were horrible civil and human rights abuses in those places. But that was supposed to be followed up with the creation of community care strategies, which are much cheaper and more effective than just using big state hospitals. But instead, that money went into building prisons and giving tax breaks to the very richest people in our society in hopes of some magical economic trickle down.
Right.
So that has created armies of people wandering the streets with severe mental illness, no resources, who continually cycle through homeless shelters, emergency rooms, and jails at huge public expense. But rather than actually provide them with services, we label them as dangerous criminals. We blame them for their situation, and we waste massive amounts of money chasing them around, never making their lives any better, and never really providing any meaningful relief to communities. It's just insane. And it's not, and it can't be reduced to some dollar and cents calculation. It's ideological. It's about maintaining the illusion that the solution to problems is criminalization, not just providing people with services they need.
So that's interesting that you don't believe that it's dollars and cents, but it's ideological. I mean, wouldn't it make more sense to say, just to follow the money, that they don't want to invest in this, that they want to give the tax breaks to the rich, or they want to build, I would think that at some point they want to build more hospitals, but okay, they take the money for hospitals and build prisons.
Yeah. So it's follow the money, though, in that bigger sense. So too often we say things like, oh, well, private prisons are the problem because a few people are getting rich building private prisons. But it's not about that. It's about the tax breaks. It's about the trillions of dollars that are being transferred. And it's providing cover for that. Because the actual criminalization of homelessness is more expensive than just housing people. But to agree to the idea of housing people is to agree that the whole politics of austerity and neoliberalism doesn't work, is corrupt. And that would endanger these larger economic arrangements that have been put in place. So that's the sense in which, yes, it's about money, but it's not about the $50 million that's spent, you know, that's saved for not, you know, creating housing. It's about the $50 billion in tax breaks that's allowed to go on because we've framed all these problems as criminal justice problems, not as market failures, housing markets, employment markets, et cetera.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Another theme of your book was homelessness, right? The gentrification of some areas, homelessness. Once again, that's, you know, ties into the mental health aspect of it.
It's the same thing, right? Is that the solution to homelessness has got to be massive government intervention into housing markets, because the free market is not capable of housing a huge proportion of the population. So instead of actually housing them by building more public housing, more supportive housing, to maintain the free market ideology, the only other alternative is to criminalize them. And so that's what's going on right now. And Trump has just laid out a whole new regime of criminalization of homelessness. That's all about blaming the homeless people as criminals who should be locked up. Instead of just providing them with supportive housing, which is much cheaper than imprisoning them.
Another point and aspect of your book was gang suppression, which I found to be very, 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 very fascinating. You know, once again, as a former officer, we thought we could arrest our way to, you know, if we arrested enough people, then people would get the picture. People would not go into criminal behaviors. But as you mentioned in your book, it's generational. And a source of pride that I've been harassed by the police and locked up.
Yeah, this is a horrible mistake that cities make. And we just, the Policing and Social Justice Project that I run, we just issued a report on this on our website, policinginjustice.org, you can see this about New York City, which had historically mostly avoided framing crime and violence problems as gang related and using gang suppression policing. And as a result, we don't have a major gang problem in New York. Yes, there are kids who call themselves this and that, and some of them are involved in violence and drug dealing, but it's so much better than the situation in Los Angeles or Chicago, where for decades, gang suppression policing has been the dominant strategy, which has just made the problem worse. We have to have a much more nuanced understanding about the lives of these young people in very poor, isolated communities, and we have to work to overcome that isolation, alienation, and poverty. And we have ways of doing that. You know, cities now increasingly understand that these violence problems are only going to be solved if we invest in those communities and in very specific community-based strategies. Violence reduction efforts that involve peer-to-peer outreach, using respected people in the community to try to break the cycle of violence. Violence interrupters, credible messengers, cure violence, these are all different sort of related frameworks for doing this. But when we try to use gang databases and RICO conspiracy cases, we're A, just feeding mass incarceration, and B, we're turning these groupings into much more hardcore gangs. In part because the origin of all these gangs historically is the criminal justice system. Every one of these big gangs we hear about, the Trinitarios, the Bloods, they're all formed in jails and prisons. So why do we think sending more young people into jails and prisons is a way to eliminate the gang problem? It's just going to make the gang problem worse.
Right, right. Another point that I thought was very salient was your talk about sex workers. Decriminalizing that. I think I read an article in, I want to say it was Vermont or New Hampshire, that is considering, I think it's Vermont, is considering some legislature, member of the legislature there is considering putting a bill or has put forth a bill that would decriminalize sex work in the state of Vermont. You heard about that. It was some article that I read somewhere. What are your thoughts about that?
So I'm all for it. There's also efforts underway in Washington, D.C., in California, in New York City, and some other places to decriminalize sex work. Yes. And I think it's absolutely essential. And these efforts are being led primarily by sex workers themselves, who are fighting to have the same kinds of rights that other workers have. And the evidence is pretty clear that decriminalization would make women and men safer who are involved in this trade. It would reduce things like trafficking and coercion, because sex workers would be able to form legitimate businesses, have security, and have basic labor rights over their working conditions, et cetera. This is good. Then we can work on questions of demand and, you know, giving women and men more opportunities so that sex work is not something that they feel they have no choice but to get involved with. You know, look at the way we treat teenage runaways in the United States. We provide almost no services for them. So they've been kicked out of their homes or they fled abusive homes and they end up on the streets and they're vulnerable to exploitation. Some turn to sex work as a survival strategy. And then we criminalize them. What are we doing to reduce the number of runaways and kids who are kicked out and to give those who do end up on the streets pathways to stability? We do almost nothing for those young people. And then we're like, oh my God, there's sex trafficking. We have to criminalize Backpage and keep this all illegal so that we can save these children. No, create an actual foster care system that supports young people. Create real family services, create shelters for young people that have decent conditions and that get them back into school and provide them avenues to self-sufficiency. But we don't do any of that.
So you're saying that there's no services for people like that? I mean, there's no services?
It's very minimal. It's right. Very minimal.
Okay.
Yeah. There are nonprofits and people who do this work, and you can talk to them and they'll tell you heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story because they don't have the resources they need and they cannot possibly serve all the young people who need their help.
My wife actually was at a job. She just left that job, but she did that type of work, and she did work for a nonprofit. She did have a lot of stories about runaways and people sleeping on different people's couches, and they call it couch surfing and technically homeless and all this kind of stuff. And of course, she did meet a lot of people who were, doing the sex trafficking for as survival sex. It was very heartbreaking, and after a long day of police work, I couldn't listen to that when she came home and went to tell me about that. I couldn't stop talking to me about that,
Right. So. And part of what's heartbreaking is that in her work, did she ever have the ability to just take a young person and put them in stable housing? No.
No, she didn't. No. Yeah, no.
No, that's never available. But that is the thing they most need. Instead, what's available is some counseling and some like job readiness program, maybe with no job at the end of it. And, here's some vouchers for, visiting the doctor or something like that one time. It's not that the people working in those places aren't trying to help these young people. It's that they do not have the resources that could actually really help them. And that's a political problem.
Do you think that there's a lack of will concerning that? And obviously the number of other things we talked about, it's particularly the sex trafficking work. And I want to ask you about not only the lack of will, but in almost indifference to their plight, because they're saying that these are choices that people are making to use drugs, to run away, to enter into sex trade, to do what you name the problem. And the more conservative thought process is, well, this is the lot in life that they chose.
Well, that's part of this conservative neoliberal austerity politics, right? Is that we have to reframe everything as individual or group moral failure, people making bad, immoral choices. And that there's so much racism suffused in that, and also a kind of, head in the sand approach that our whole culture is invested in, that says that, everyone is personally responsible for every little thing that happens to them.
Right.
You got struck by lightning because you didn't pray in the morning. It's like that. The fact that you lost your house in a hurricane was because, you weren't rich enough to build your house somewhere else.
Right.
It's like, no, there are structural forces at work. There's a long legacy of racial exploitation and the stealing of wealth of entire communities. And that structures people's life opportunities. And yes, people make some decisions within that framework, and we want to help people make better decisions, but we can't be naive about the terrible situations that people find themselves in. And we also ignore the horrible immorality of decisions that rich people make every day. To exploit people, to take advantage of people, to ruin their own lives and their own families, but somehow they need another tax break. That's the solution when they make a mistake. How many times did Trump go bankrupt?
Ugh,
how many crazy. Wives and girlfriends did he mistreat?
Right.
How many people did he steal money from? But the solution to his problems is another multi-million-dollar loan from a bank, another tax break, right? That's never labeled immorality that should be dealt with through punishment and coercion. So lots of people make mistakes. Lots of people make bad choices. And we need to figure out how to help people make better choices. And yes, that means putting pressure on them in some ways, but from a position of respect and humanity, not one of degrading them.
You mentioned the legacy of stealing from communities of color, particularly. I tried to stay away from this, but we'll get into it a little bit. The history of course, law enforcement, of course, the desegregated housing, redlining, and all that kind of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about how this has formed these urban ghetto communities?
Sure. I mean, people want to have this discourse about, well, yeah, slavery was something that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago, and everybody needs to quit complaining. But systematic, legally enforced exploitation of communities of color continues to this day. It occurred during the era after Reconstruction, Jim Crow, the ghettoization, the legalized ghettoization of blacks to prevent them from being able to establish businesses, to build up home equity. The way that the mortgage bailout was handled by the Obama administration was a massive transfer of wealth from communities of color to international banks.
Crazy.
The Obama administration could have bailed out the homeowners, not the banks. People could have stayed in their homes. The banks would have gotten paid, so they would have remained solvent, and we would have avoided making another million people homeless, mostly people of color. But instead, the decision was made to just give the money to the banks and then to evict all those people from their homes. So this is an ongoing problem. This is not ancient history. So people want to talk about reparations. I'm like, can we just stop committing new harms? Let's start there. Then we can talk about remedying past harms, but they're not past yet. They're ongoing.
That's very true. Very true.
And of course, the police have historically played a role in, to get back to your question, have played a role in allowing that system of exploitation to continue, whether it's driving people into convict leasing and prison farms under Jim Crow, maintaining the race line to allow the redlining of communities so that their housing is of no value, enforcing, you know, anti-labor laws that disproportionately affect people of color, you know, criminalizing homelessness, et cetera, the police are always a tool in this process.
And up until recently, and of course, I don't know, but I would say up until recently, the police were definitely mentally, you know, individually in line with this. I mean, as you would talk, I would assume that you talked to more police officers today. And I talked to a number of other scholars who also would agree that they've talked to officers who don't want to be making these arrests today. So I would assume that there's been a shift in the cultural thinking along the lines of racial segregation and all that. So police officers are thinking differently, I would assume. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it's uneven, right? I mean, there are just straight up racist white supremacist police officers.
Of course.
You know, when we look for them, we find them.
Right.
That's part of why this talk of implicit bias training is so ridiculous, because there's a lot of explicit bias in policing.
Right.
But in big cities like Detroit and Baltimore and DC and even New York and Los Angeles, a majority of the officers now, Philadelphia, are non-white.
Right.
And a lot of the leadership is non-white. And in some of these cities, it's all non-white. So to say that the policing, the problematic policing, is driven by like personal racial animus is really not very helpful.
Mm.
You know, the problems of race and policing are in the decision to use police to solve communities, you know, problems in communities of color, so that every time something bad happens in a black or brown community and the politician says we need to give that to the police, that's where the racism is. In there are plenty of places in Connecticut and Westchester County where when there's a problem in that upscale white community, the politicians do not say, let's give it to the police. There are a lot of people in those communities who do not want the police to have anything to do with their problems. When Jimmy gets caught with drugs at some elite prep school in Connecticut, nobody's calling the police. Oh, Jimmy, why did you bring that marijuana to school? Give that to me. We're going to maybe call your parents. But they're not calling the police. Why? Because that's the last thing their parents want. Why? Because they know that nothing good can come from that. The last thing they want is their kid having anything to do with the criminal justice system. But when that happens in a poor black community, the first call is to the police. Let's get the police involved. Let's teach these kids a lesson. And then their lives are ruined for no good reason.
You're really saying something.
So this idea that we can't have, you know, police abolition or something, in these rich communities, they already have police abolition for their problems. They just don't want to let the rest of us have it.
Keeping more all to themselves. There's that greed again.
Yeah.
One thing I found to be very, very personal to me, and I, of course, everything is very personal that you mentioned in the book and in this whole police reform movement, is this idea of political policing, right? You talk about COINTELPRO and what's going on even today, right? The amount of surveillance that's going on. I was listening to a talk by Noam Chomsky the other day. I'm sure you know who he is.
Sure.
So he's talking about this surveillance that's going on and what's going on with our cell phones. And I tell a story a lot of times that I was, my wife and I, we were on some trip a few years back, and this is a couple of years ago, so I'm sure the technology has advanced since then, but we were on a trip and I had the email for the trip came through Hotmail, my Microsoft Hotmail, separate company, Microsoft. I Googled the address to where we're going, Google another company, and it says, you'll be at this location in 3 days or something like that. I'm like, you know, how are these two companies talking to each other and knowing where I'm going to be? You know, so I was very offended at that. And of course, this is corporations. We know that the government has more policing. They know what we're doing. You talked about the crowd control. Can you just talk a little bit about all that?
So there was a piece that just came out in Reason magazine about the fact that the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, filed a whole series of freedom of information requests with the FBI to find out if they were collecting intelligence on a long list of perfectly lawful political organizations involved in lobbying around, you know, First Amendment issues and Fourth Amendment issues, et cetera. And in every single one of them, the FBI says we can neither confirm or deny that we have an investigation underway. And the group defending rights and dissent issued a report late last year that recounted, you know, 20 years of improper FBI spying on legitimate political groups. Because as we make demands to redistribute wealth more equitably, the state is going to come down on us. And whenever our movements become more radical and more successful, we can expect to see more surveillance, infiltration, and disruption. And the clearest evidence of this is that as soon as Black Lives Matter and the movements associated with have become more organized and mobilized, we start seeing them labeled black identity extremists.
Right.
We start to see more surveillance, and we have to remain constantly vigilant about that. Now, the trick is to not become paranoid in a way that undermines our ability to organize, that we don't self-censor ourselves. We have to understand that the state may be listening, but that what we're doing is necessary and legitimate. Mm. And the thing to do, in my opinion, is to just be more public, to be more straightforward, and to constantly build our alliances and our collective strength so that we can better resist the surveillance and infiltration and disruption. And we also have to train ourselves how to deal with that, how to be mindful of people who are disruptive influences in our movements. We may not be able to prove whether or not they're an infiltrator, but in a sense, it doesn't matter, because if they're disrupting our movements, we have to get them out of our movements or get them to change their behavior. So let's not become paranoid. Let's not go underground, you know, but let's be prepared to protect ourselves in a variety of ways. And there are a lot of groups out there, you know, who are exploring those ideas.
Mm. Well, I think, I don't know if Black Lives Matter is underground, because I've contacted them or reached out to them a couple of times. They haven't responded.
They're not. Okay. No, I'm just saying in general, like other groups historically have responded to this by embracing a kind of security culture.
Right.
Where they want to do their actions and have their affinity groups and be completely private and underground. And this undermines their ability to organize.
Right. I understand.
To bring new people in. So that's what I want to avoid.
Right. Oh, I got you. And I definitely agree. And I hope that if anyone's listening from Black Lives Matter, I actually thought about changing the name of my podcast a couple of times, because I can't get people to email me back a lot of times. You know, those who are more radical. I mean, they may think that I'm, I don't know what they think, but mm-hmm. anyway, you know, so. So do you think that you get a lot more traction because you are a white male saying this type of thing, that people are more apt to listen to you rather than a Black person who may be seen as whining and crying about the status quo?
I think it's complicated. So there are different settings. So in some places, yes, a white professor has access to media and some elected officials and some other folks. You know, in other settings, there is a strong movement now that there's a strong sense that these movements need to be led by people who've been most directly affected, people of color, et cetera. And so they actually don't want to hear from some middle-class white professor. So it's a mixed bag. For instance, a tremendous amount of progressive foundation funding now, they only want to talk to, you know, those folks who are in most directly affected communities. So I can't get, for instance, meetings to talk about, you know, where should money be spent, et cetera, in a lot of places. So it's in some media settings, they only want to talk. They don't want to hear criticism of police from white professors. They only want to hear it from Black folks who, you know, are from communities where this is a problem.
Now, why would that be?
So it's
that's got to be so contradictory. Why would that be? They only want to hear it from.
But think about it. Think about it. Even like on MSNBC and even like Democracy Now and CNN, et cetera, when there were discussions about what to do about policing, the kinds of people who are allowed to be on to have those discussions are kind of former prosecutors, former cops, right, sort of defending the police,
right.
And then some journalists of color, some Black community activists, a couple of Black academics, but never sort of white academics or white activists.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's the reality of the landscape. right? So if I was if I wrote a very conservative book about policing,
I'm sure you'd be called.
Then
up
I could get on.
Right.
Then
right.
I would be called up left and right to right. defend the police as a legitimate police scholar or whatever. But that's not the situation. The reality is that the reception to the book has been extremely positive. I'm on the road every other week. I'm in 25 cities a year, and most of that is in support of organizing happening in communities. And I'm very excited to be doing that work and to support organizing and kind of policy thinking among, you know, organizations trying to do this work. So none of this should be understood as some sort of complaint. It's just kind of laying out the realities of the landscape. And there are, you know, we're seeing more books coming from the, you know, folks who've been involved in putting various forms of the Black Lives Matter movement together. And this is fantastic. And I've done what I can to, you know, support these authors, and I write blurbs for books if people ask me, and I publicize things on my social media platforms and assign these books to my students. So it's very exciting that these opportunities are improving, but there's much more work to be done to lift up the voices of people doing work in communities that has this deeper analysis.
And what's your prognosis for the future? I mean, are you optimistic that these forces that we talked about, all these changes, the numerous changes and suggestions that you have in the book, as far as, you know, the homeless and all the things that we talked about, and I would encourage people to go out and read the book and so you can understand the changes that you have proposed. Are you optimistic that these changes can and will one day be come into effect?
I think we can make a huge amount of progress on this. And the thing that I see that's really encouraging is the number of organizations around the country who've quit calling for body cameras and implicit bias training and instead are demanding drug treatment on demand and real mental health services and real community anti-violence efforts. And, you know, I think we're going to see progress, more progress on decriminalizing sex work, legalizing drugs, getting cops out of schools. But there's also a huge amount to be done. And it's not going to be won through little technocratic advancements. I mean, we've got to start electing more really left-wing politicians. That's going to create the political space to get the things we want. And that means we need more people to run for office on a clear left-wing platform where racial and economic justice is at the center of their analysis.
That certainly is a radical stance to have them all left-wing. Wow. Wow. That's going to take some.
But we're seeing this. So. People are getting elected. People are running for office. We're getting... We've been transforming these DA offices, DSA, you know, Democratic Socialists of America candidates are winning election in places as being openly socialist. So, you know, I see some positive signs there. You know, Bernie Sanders has a real shot at winning the Democratic nomination. So that would create a tremendous amount of political space. It's not going to solve all our problems overnight. It's just part of building, you know, this politics more broadly.
I would assume that you have some conservative friends, Republican friends. We talked about, you know, the response of the book, but how is your response when you say things like that, that we need more left-wing people? What has been the response from your friends?
Yeah, well, they're obviously not sympathetic to that. Some of them are sympathetic to this idea that we've, you know, turned too many things over to the police, that it's not efficient, that it's counterproductive. And, you know, there are conservatives who see inequality as a problem. They just think the solution is to further unleash free markets to get government even more out of the picture. And so that's a kind of irreconcilable difference between us.
Now, do they see more of these conservative people, in your opinion, do they see that these the barriers to their own economic success is because they're racist, right? not that they are racist, but there's racial implications to it, right? A lot of social safety nets we don't have because they feel, many conservatives will feel that if you give all this stuff to minority communities, it'll make them lazy or whatever. And so therefore they oppose a lot of things that would help their own communities. Are they able to understand that in Europe?
No, I mean, this is one of the ways in which, you know, racism perverts the kind of ethical judgment of so many people in our society, so that they oppose state support for people because they don't want it to go to black people. So that's why we can't have national health care, and why we can't have real family leave programs and decent unemployment insurance and actual paid vacations, you know, and things like that, is because there are too many people who think that that will just go to immigrants and black people who are lazy and will waste the money.
Wow.
And that's just straight up racism.
Right.
They don't think of themselves as racist, but it is. And so we got a lot of work to do on trying to figure out a racial justice agenda that can help us overcome some of that. We're never going to win everyone over, and we don't have to. We just got to get to 51% in the key states, you know, that will allow for an electoral majority at the national level, as well as, you know, we got to win a lot more stuff at the local and state level too. So it's really, I think that, you know, the kind of left democratic socialist agenda that's out there right now is making progress on organizing people across race lines for a real social and economic and racial justice agenda. And that's the work that needs to keep happening, is figuring out what that agenda is, how to build across race lines to create new, real working majorities politically.
Very good. So we'll wrap it up right there. I thank you so much for being on the podcast. Can you tell us what you got coming up? Any new books that you're working on? Any new articles? You've got tons of articles that I got to still read through. what else do you have going on?
People can go to my website, alex-vitali.info, for upcoming appearances, recent news articles, etc. And folks can follow me on Twitter at avitale, A-V-I-T-A-L-E.
Very good. I definitely followed you on all those. And like I said, I still have a number of articles. You're going to keep me busy for a long time as far as reading your publication. So, and I appreciate
that. That's the plan.
And I enjoy learning, and it's very informative. A lot of things I did not know. And even, let me just bring this up as the last point. You know, I knew about the racism that was going on as far as the founding of the police forces. I did not know explicitly about the Texas Rangers and how they were used to, kind of keep Texas for the white people and kick out the Mexicans and all that kind of stuff. That was so that I learned something new that I did not know before, and I thought I knew a lot about the history of the American policing. So that was very informative. So
great.
I highly suggest that people check out your book. Make sure that you read it, The End of Policing. Thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast.
My pleasure.
Once again, I want to thank my special guests, Professor Alex Vitali, for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. A lot of great information that he gave out. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for your work as far as trying to bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share these episodes. Remember, the podcast can be supported through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo. Also, follow Alex Vitali at A-V-I-T-A-L-E on Twitter, and head on over to his website, alex-vitali.info. And so therefore you can follow him and see what other articles and everything like that he has been doing. A lot of great information he's given out. Last but not least, if you know of anyone who wants to become a police officer or wants to take a promotional exam, have them contact me, CPTL Hunter, or my other email address, hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com. Head over to the website, hunterpolicetraining.com. They can either we can either do live one-on-one sessions or they can sign up for my online courses. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time, much love and peace.